Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This week, I am joined by the lovely and amazing Janet Varney, who is here with me to talk to Susan Simpson of the Proof Podcast. Susan, how are you?
Good. Hey, guys. Good to see y'all again. It's been a minute.
This is very exciting.
I last saw you. What city were we in? We were in Tennessee.
I had you on my podcast. I had you on the JV Club live, which is always a different experience than just doing it in front of a computer. I remember I was very nervous because I was such a fan. And then only after you had done the podcast were you like, wait, I like something you do. I just didn't realize it until now. But yeah, it was so great to be with you in person. And people are like, everyone that listens to our podcast that I know listens to Proof, people are just losing their mind over both the seasons that you've done. This latest season, obviously, you just dropped your last episode. Your last episode for now. And I mean, it's so well put together. The dynamic between you and Jacinda and then Kevin when he's there is fantastic. And I've loved it. It's been so compelling.
Well, thank you. So, I'm really hopeful this one will have updates sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a crazy, I said I had to cheat and skip to the end. As I was trying to catch up, but then yeah, it leaves on a pretty big cliffhanger where you guys found a bunch of stuff, which encourages me a lot for the case that I'm getting ready to start right now. But let's start. Let's go, because I haven't talked to you, Susan, since you started Proof, since Undisclosed ended and you started Proof. So how did this come about? How did you and Jacinda hook up? How did you come up with this idea for Proof?
Jacinda and I met actually because we ended up doing the same case. Her for her TV show. They do a lot of shows on Discovery ID. This one was for Killer in Question, and they covered the Jeff Titus case, which they told me about. We started talking. We're like, well, you know what? It's a great case for Undisclosed, too. So we did it at the same time, and it worked really well. It ended up having just an unexpected advantage of how the TV and podcasting worlds work together to kind of best of both worlds, to get witnesses on board, to get people to give info, different audiences. And we saw how well that worked and ended up talking about other cases we knew about, including one I had been looking at forever in Georgia. And that ended up being season one of Proof. And Lee Clark and Josh Story are now home.
That's so fast.
I know. Super quick turnaround.
People are going to like see that and be like, oh, that's how this goes, right? No, it'll never happen that way ever again.
It's insane. Like, I hadn't had a chance to, like, my audience was like, I never have time to listen to any true crime, but I'm always like trying to find little things here and there. And I'm like, oh, so I kind of had like bookmarked, like, Susan started a new show. I want to listen to Proof. And before I got a chance to listen, you already had him out of prison.
Yeah.
What the hell?
New listeners are going to be like, every other season, be like, so why is it taking so long? Like, it's only been 2 years. That's nothing in this world.
Yeah, that's why I jumped to the last episode of this season. I'm like, clearly she's getting him out.
You better race to the finish. Yeah. I know. So for the first season, you just talked about it a little bit, but that was a situation in which, not to give too terribly much away, but this is a situation in which it seemed as though perhaps there had been an accident or some sort of situation in which a person took their own life. And yet it turned into it's more than that. There's more happening here. It's, you know, murder. And somehow you just walked right through all of that, got the two guys who were accused out of prison. But you had cooperation, a little bit of cooperation from the victim, as it were, family.
The victim's family,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and then that kind of happened again. Yeah. And then that kind of happened again in Manteca with season two. Can you tell us a little bit about the framework for anybody who hasn't dipped into season two yet of Proof?
Yeah, season two is in Manteca, California, Central Valley. So like an hour and change outside of, I mean, it's from the Bay Area. It was another 2000 case. I feel like almost all my cases end up either being cases that happened in 99, 2000, or the trials were held then. And an 18-year-old girl was found strangled, left dead in a construction site, actually for a new Home Depot being built. And she had a boyfriend that had a very tumultuous relationship with her. He was obviously the first suspect. They focus on him, try to get him, can't quite get a case together until eventually trying to get the obvious answer, come up with the least obvious answer in the history of the world. and decide that this was a mass gang rape party, that she was lured to this party to celebrate a pregnancy, her pregnancy. And while there, 5, 6, 7 guys rape and strangle her in front of 20 to 40 other teenagers.
Including several of her closest friends.
Including several of her closest friends. And
yeah,
according to the prosecution, only one of these teenagers ever comes forward. One of them says he was there, he saw it, here's what happened. Not one other teenager is ever found, as far as the trial is made aware, to talk about the party. And it didn't happen. Obviously, it didn't happen. Everyone who hears a story, like the real story about what was supposed to have occurred, pretty much immediately would go like, wait, that's what they said happened in the trial? Okay, well, I think Jake and Ty, the could have been there, guilty, but like that's clearly nonsense.
So, I mean, it's laughable, and no one likes to giggle when they're talking about a tragic event, but some of the pieces of the story are so preposterous, it sounds like a bad sketch on like SNL or something. Like, it's just like, well, that's, no one's ever going to believe that. They did believe it. Okay, all right, well, that's where the tragedy comes in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to back up real quick to season one, because I feel more comfortable giving spoilers for because if you haven't listened to season one yet, then you just deserve the spoilers. How did you turn that? Can you share like how you were able to turn that case around and get them released so quickly?
In that case, it's kind of similar in that the basic story was pretty laughable. And once you show the reality of it and show how the case was built together, it wasn't hard for people who even, like the victim's family, the certain family heard it, and they thought all along that these two guys have been guilty. But really just hearing the evidence for themselves was all it took for them to realize something bad had happened here, and then eventually conclude that no, these two guys are not guilty. And that is definitely why it was possible to get progress so fast, because politically it became much more, not just tenable, like there was pressure on them to do something. The Floyd County DA's office was not inclined to help out. In fact, they actually called the victim's family and told them to stop talking to podcasters, that their office had worked so hard to get justice for their family, and how dare they try and like undermine that now. So they were at first on a board, and then eventually Kane's attorney, Josh's attorney, was a local who was actually a former prosecutor there, now his attorney, and he knew who to talk to, who to bring arguments to, basically how to show them that they really needed to get out of the way and just do the right thing. And it happened. It sounds easy, like, oh, but just do that. It's not. It's a lot harder than that. But
I'm just taking notes, so that's all I need to
that's
do.
All you do. Easy, easy.
I've been doing this wrong the whole time.
Did
the prosecution end up joining a motion to overturn it? Because clearly you didn't have to fight it in that short period of time.
Yes and no. Yes, they agreed to overturn it. Unfortunately, they wanted to get their vengeance somehow. And the DA had a sticking point where she was requiring one of the defendants, Josh Story, to plead guilty to something else. Now, he brought the gun. So the two boys were playing Russian roulette, or at least one of them was. They're both joking about playing it, and then one played it for real and lost. And the boy who lived, the one who brought the gun there in the first place. So he ended up pleading guilty to a count of essentially involuntary manslaughter with a predicate offense of bringing a gun to the house.
And was sentenced to time served?
Time served, yeah. Well, 10 years, and they were 23 for war, so he was out. But that has real implications for the future, too, because not only is he... Well, he was actually had that record expunged immediately, so it's not on his record, but it does make it much harder for him to get compensation. Now, in the end, Lee Clark has also not gotten compensation, so, you know, it seemed like he's worse off. But yeah, it theoretically, assuming that Georgia was doing things right, it would have made it so that even if Lee was able to get compensated, Josh might not. Of course, Georgia's so fucked up. No one is.
The Lee aspect is just bonkers.
Yeah, nothing to do with anything. Lee Clark is kind of the same as Ty Lopes in the current season, and that is someone who just had literally no reason to be part of this. Like, you're like, why are they here? They're here because someone else has to be part of it.
What a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're going to kind of walk through some of season two. So for those of you listening, if you haven't heard towards the end, we might get to some spoilers, and you might want to hit pause and go listen to season two of Proof before you come back, because I don't want to not talk about some of the stuff that you found. But I want to talk to you a little bit about, even selfishly, your fight to get records and the way you discovered records in that case. Because I'm currently going through it. We talked a little bit off the air. Well, first, when I was listening and you were talking about the police department not giving up any documents, which I thought was insane until I heard you say California. And we just went season 12 with the Pinyon Pines case. Their open records laws in California are essentially, it seems like they can just, for no. any reason they want to, just not give you anything.
For no reason. No reason. That they don't even need a reason.
Yep.
Yeah. The reason they gave us a reason. So in our case, it was a triple homicide. And one of the victims' father, who was another one of the victims' ex-husband, who lived 10 hours away, used to work as a county sheriff. And they're like, this involves a county employee, so we don't have to give you the records.
Oh, they gave you a reason. They don't have to. I didn't.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's how nice of them to make something up.
Yeah, we had some of our listeners are attorneys, tried filing appeals for it, and like tried to take it to the attorney, and nothing. We just could not get anything in that case. And so my current case is in Michigan. It's right here in my county. And actually, I have a little update for my listeners. So, and this is interesting. So I had filed the records request for the police file and the DA file. And the police told me, oops, and this is a murder case. Oops. We shredded that file. It's gone. And I'm like, well, how is that possible? You can't do that. And they're it was a former chief didn't understand record retention laws. So they shredded it. So I'm like, okay, well, the DA will have a copy of that file. Mm-hmm. So I go to the DA and I ask for the police file and for copies of the trial exhibits. And they won't tell me where the trial exhibits are. And it's gone on. And I've talked a little bit. I haven't named the agency, but I've talked a little bit about it on the podcast and then had some email exchanges with the district attorney, essentially telling them what I'm doing. And that we were just talking about this on our live last night about like the pressure from doing podcasts and stuff like this. And I told them, say, listen, everything you do, I'm not trying to intimidate you, but you need to know everything you do. 100,000 people are going to be listening and they're all going to be, you know, writing you and emailing you and calling you. So just be aware of that. Just giving you a heads up. While we were having that conversation, I had those email exchanges with the DA. While we were having that conversation, like while we were live at 8:30 PM, I got a message back from the police department that says, we found the file and we're going to send you the copy.
Yeah.
At 8:30. Watching. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe it's a coincidence, but I don't know what records person is working wild. At 8:30 at night doing
yeah,
that. But yeah,
that's pretty wild.
Yeah. So hopefully I have that file coming. So what struggles did you go through trying to find files for this case?
It was not really a struggle. It's just like a flat out no. That's not
so
true.
How do you handle it?
So here's, we did have records from the defense files. Luckily, between Ty and Jake, family members, people involved had kept copies of like sufficiently, like most of it. We had, I think, 95% of everything that was handed over. Of course, stuff we probably really want is stuff they didn't hand over ever. And that we still don't have. But they denied all requests. And here's one thing in California, there is an exception. California can say no for any reason except to victims and victims' representatives. They are entitled to copies of a large subset of it. Not everything, but like witness statements, witness addresses, witness names. They're supposed to get that in California law. Well, Donna Ramos, the mother of the victim in this case, she signed a letter requesting copies of all those records a few months ago now. You're like, cool, that's what you had. Like, we tried it with other cases we wanted there. We found victims, family members who did the request for us, and they did get the files, so it did work. Mm-hmm. They tried it for this case, and they said, sorry, no, here's one initial police statement, like the day of, and then a 10-page list of redacted names, which is actually not allowed under California law. So you heard on the final episode, slight spoiler, she's resubmitted a request, and I don't know how it's going to go. I'm not optimistic, but that's a case of where actually California law was on our side and they still said no.
Yeah. So, and they're probably trying to find the exception for, but what if they're talking to a podcaster?
Unfortunately for them, that's one thing California has not yet done. I'm sure they're working on it, but they're not there yet.
Yeah.
But that does work. I mean, we did that with Sandy Melgar's case and they were kind of stonewalling me for documents, but the daughter of the victim filed a request and then they turned everything over to her. Cause and like in Texas, they won't give any crime scene photos that were the body that, you know, there's all kinds of laws about that, but they will to the family. So she was able to get all that stuff and then pass it on to me. So hopefully that works out. So how did you basically just proceeded? Cause that's kind of where I'm at now. I'm going, I think their hope in my case was that I would just go away if I didn't have all the documents that I needed. but not I'm going forward and just boots on the ground interviewing people and doing the investigation that way. How did you handle not having everything that you needed?
I mean, you do what you can. The documents are great. You need them, but also like the records aren't always accurate or what you want for reinvestigating. They're good for, they're important for like Brady violations, finding that kind of stuff and like finding bad acts by the investigators, but they don't always help you with finding out the truth of what happened. So, you know, that's always good to have. It's not always a measurable loss. So you just redo redo it from scratch. You find the witnesses, you talk to them. You can't always challenge what they said before. If you don't have a copy of it, at least you can find out what they say now.
Right.
And so having just listened to that episode when it came out, this final episode and the outreach that you make to the general public for legal assistance for Jake, like he definitely needs representation and needs to be someone who can do it pro bono. You did so much legwork just to try to have better news, it sounded like, for the last episode. And then also, so would a next step then be, because you have somebody who you talk to, and this is, I guess, falls into the spoiler category if you haven't listened to season two at all, folks, but you have someone who says, hey, I did bring this information to the police. It is a potential Brady violation. Without being able to check it against any records, would the next step on that be, once he has representation, then you are really talking about, you know, a plea that asks for that information?
So that the thing is, it doesn't matter. The defendant's not allowed to get, it's not like they have a better access than we do. Like the defendant does not have more access to the records than anyone else. So that actually would not be something that his attorney would necessarily have better luck getting. Now,
then how the hell can you ever talk about Brady in the state of California?
That's a feature, not a bug. The thing is, like, you don't need that. Like, the Brady violation does not depend on a document saying it is. Like, the Brady violation is in the fact that you have a witness that talked to the cops and that was never turned.
Yeah.
Proving it can be hard, but again, why would this guy ever make that up? He has no concept of Brady violation. He has no concept of what he says is important legally. He's not, like, he's saying something that's damaging to him, that he had that's not something anyone in this world wants to admit they talked to a cop. Like, that's not something he was eager to share. Like, he's like, okay, here's what happened. He's credible in that sense, like, he has no reason to lie about that whatsoever and every reason not to disclose it. And the fact the cop is dead means we can't ask him for confirmation, but like that cop probably talked to others about it. So, you know, get them on the stand, ask them. The lack of records is not going to be the deal breaker there. Although honestly, he has so many other claims too, that I feel like that may not be where the fight comes down to. And plus there's there's the, hopefully the be all end all answer, and we'll make any sort of legal wrangling post conviction proceedings moot.
And also, I was going to say earlier, that's what I meant to mention, is your statement out to, you know, the current DA's office saying, like, you have this opportunity. You have an opportunity to do what's right. And we don't have to sit around and wait for a lawyer to show up. You can absolutely take action on this now, which I thought was really meaningful. The other thing that I wanted to, and well, we see some questions rolling in too, but just comment on, if nothing else, is to say that, you know, again, I said it at the beginning of the episode, but the dynamic that you guys have, and I think we really get such a flavor of that in the way that you've produced and released this podcast. You feel like you're along for the ride in kind of a new, fresh way. I don't think we get that as much with Undisclosed. Towards the end, I think there was more, in some cases, with you and Jacinda talking in the car.
Boots or,
you know, with Rabia, being boots on the ground. But for me, it really struck me, like, it felt like this dynamic is working with the people that you're talking to. And I just thought that was very inspiring. Like, it feels like you're really getting people to talk and to trust you. And there are a lot of women in the case that we're talking about, a lot of friends, a lot of family who are women who are talking about, you know, a horrific thing that happened to another woman in their lives. And I just think it's kind of remarkable that you have such a great vibe, frankly, with the people that you talked to on the podcast, including people who maybe get too comfortable and say things that they shouldn't because you guys are good at your jobs. Is that something that you felt, that you really feel when you're boots on the ground with your team?
Yeah, well, Jacinda and I are very different. Our approach is very different in how we investigate and talk to people. And we've definitely realized that's a strength. And we sort of have a, we don't really talk about it. Like, we'll meet a witness and we'll kind of get a sense sort of right away, like, who should take the lead? Like, who's the one to, like, we don't really even negotiate. Like, you talk to this person, I'll talk to this one. Kind of just naturally happens. Like, this is what I'm going to be talking to. This is what I'll be handling. And just whoever you match better with, or just whoever is going to have the connection there that is genuine and leads to real conversations, which is the important thing.
That's great.
I want to circle back real quick to the fact that you said that the defense is not any more entitled to documents than, you know, the general public. Like, how does that work with discovery laws?
Well, during the case, it's different. When the case is actually ongoing, that's different. That's how we have files now, because during the trial, they didn't get records. They're entitled to those records. But once it's over, once it's no longer an active proceeding, they have no greater obligation to hand it over to a defendant than they do to anyone else, except for victims' families, who they do have to hand it over to. And
it just seems such a free-for-all. So we dealt with, in our Season 12 case, kind of a really weird situation where there were cell phone records that I believe exonerate the defendants. They had, you remember from Adnan's case, you know, they had like a basic call, cell phone report, and then they had the call detail report that showed all the sectors and the transfers and all that stuff. And the prosecution at trial told the defense they didn't have those and it was too late to get them. Weirdly, they had actually already received them and had turned them over in discovery. So the defense actually had them in their files. Didn't know they had it, and then stipulated at trial that they didn't exist when both sides had them in their files.
And the defense didn't realize it?
No, we found it. Like, when I was going through the
file.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, unfortunately. That they can, sometimes prosecutors just hide things, don't give it over. Sometimes they do the opposite and try and bury the other side, and hope that they won't find whatever needle they've hidden in the haystack, which I prefer, obviously. I'll take that anytime.
Susan's going to find it. Susan's going to find that needle.
But it can be effective, too, for defense attorneys who are overworked or not necessarily.
Sure.
Yeah. You
know. Yeah. In our case, it wasn't me. It was a listener that found it, because it was buried in the files. I have some listeners that have full access to stuff that help us out. Mm-hmm. And it was like there was folders that said like cell phone records, cell phone data. And then there was like this one folder with just like some guy's name on it, and like buried in there, that was the name of the guy that filed the subpoena. And like, boom, there's the records that everybody stipulated didn't exist, which I'm sure is going to be an interesting filing when they file their habeas in the fall, and how they go about that, because it was there the whole time.
Yeah, this is where the intersection of like Brady and IAC is always a problematic, because in most of these cases, it's not clearly one or the other. Like, there's definitely a Brady violation, and it's exacerbated by defense attorneys who are just not on the ball. And they sometimes can get away with that way, because they say it's not either, because it's kind of both.
Right. So this case, you can't say it's Brady, because they're like, what do you mean? We did give it to you. It was in the discovery. And then,
that one's going to be IAC, I think, more so.
Yeah.
But
because they stipulated that they didn't, that something didn't exist that they had in their file the whole time. And then of course there's the battle of, is it material or not, is I'm sure the fight that we'll be fighting. In that regard, I had a question here in the live chat. Tool Girl wants to know, is there any legislation being proposed in California that you're aware of to change some of these laws to make it easier for defendants to access?
Not that I'm aware of. Now, but there is also a recent law change. A year or two ago, they actually introduced, there was a big movement to pass a new law in California to allow challenges to scientific evidence to be more easily brought. And as far as I'm aware, that's not actually been used yet in any cases. I think that Jake's case would be an amazing opportunity for it to be put into action, because there's so much with the forensics here that was done inappropriately that... it'd be a great test case for this new law that basically allows like scientific evidence with new information, new evidence that's found, to be brought without being blocked by various procedural issues. And in this case, like, just the medical examiner alone, what he said at trial, I think would qualify as new scientific evidence for Jake, because the pregnancy issue was so central to that case.
How egregious. Wow.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah, that almost like felt like from a non-lawyer. I'm like, how is that? That's got to be a due process violation of some kind. Like, he literally is false testimony. It was 100%
it is false testimony.
I mean, I can't say he's lying because I don't know like what's in his head. I can say we know he's wrong. We don't know why he said that. Again, his record makes it very clear that he is someone you can. If you're the attorney who has brought him on board, you can probably get him to say whatever you want. Like the case where the man died of 27 stab wounds, but just coincidentally died of a heart attack in the middle of the knife attack.
Again, SNL sketch.
There was another case, different case, where he was brought in to say it was self-defense because the victim had so many stab wounds. The medical examiner argued that it was a sign of how violent and scary he was because it took that many stab wounds to kill him. And that's why it was proof of self-defense.
And this is working? Like these are in cases where...
Oh, those didn't work. Didn't
okay.
work. Yeah, <right. laughs> it didn't work out for them. But he still made the argument.
And he's still getting called in to do stuff. So it's like, you know, it's not like he had to retreat into a... Oh, yeah.
This is all like right after Jake's case. He's not been active for several years, as far as we can tell. He lost his license to practice. He's still... So basically the same... Within a year of Jake's case, he lost his license. But he was still able to be an expert witness to give his opinion. But he couldn't do autopsies anymore or do any medicine.
I mean, I would hope that any good attorney on the other side would be like, let me just break this down for everyone.
Here's your expert.
You can't do what anymore now? Yeah.
You're not allowed to touch
the phone's
people,
not going to be ringing off the hook for this guy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And for the record, so we had one line in the show that I was, was told was not allowed to do. And that's where there's a recording of me talking about this medical examiner. And I called him a total fucking hat. So sadly, that was not scientific enough to leave it in, but I still stand by my opinion there.
I mean, you have the evidence. Do we need to take this to a court? You definitely have plenty of exhibits to show.
Yes.
Allison in our chat says, I want to know if Susan's going to take the California bar to represent
Jake. Absolutely not. I would do a lot for Jake. I would do a lot for him, any of my defendants, but I will absolutely not do that.
I need to do more research into exonerees in California because it seems like I never hear about them and it seems virtually impossible. Like, what is an Innocence Project in California? I mean, other than DNA, which is what we bump into so many times with Innocence Projects across the United States, but here, like, not even being able to see the investigation that was done in any meaningful way, unless you have the victim's family on board to get some of that documentation, it just feels so daunting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you do have the trial file still, then theoretically that's a good start. I mean, it does mean that if there's stuff they didn't hand over to trial counsel, no one's ever going to get it.
Yeah.
But like with a lot of innocence groups out there, just the resources are always an issue and they prefer to work with like DNA cases because that's much more manageable.
Right.
And I will say I am optimistic that we will get counsel for Jake. I'm not at this point too worried about that. So there's definitely, it's a work in progress. You know, ideally, in my perfect world, we would have gotten counsel on board, got the stuff submitted for testing, maybe even have an answer before the last episode aired. Didn't work out, but we'll get there eventually.
It's still a damn impressive amount of work by the end.
Yeah. On that topic, Caroline wanted to know if we can raise money for a decent attorney for Jake. Is there any fundraising been talked about, or do you have any attorneys that are on board? And she wants to know, what would something like that cost?
Like $1 million? I mean, probably not $1 million. It would be a lot. I'm hopeful it won't come to that. If it does, then, you know, I'll come back and put another episode out and like beg for help. But I'm optimistic that we'll find something to work. It's not that there aren't attorneys who would be interested in helping Jake. It's just there's always so much in the it's not just a question of like this attorney likes the case, they're gonna take it. Like there's just so much about the right person, right time, right place, and trying to get those pieces all lined up. It's harder than you'd expect. And often the troubles that you run into are not the ones you'd anticipate.
Mm.
Sure. Did you have something, Janet?
No, I was just gonna say on the flip side of that, Barb in the chat wants to know if, you know, we're not raising money for Jake, is there a way to have that kind of groundswell? And when is the right time to do that? You know, you don't like, rather than pissing someone off, when is the right time to sort of be inflooded with people saying, will you please take a look at this? Take a look at this. Take a look at this.
Yeah, to petition the county to review the case.
Yeah, I think the first step is to see if we can get counsel on board relatively quick and let them figure it out and talk to them. I mean, if you're in San Joaquin County, like that's your government. That's your people. They're obligated to be responsive to you. So those citizens of that county should definitely do whatever they feel is right to talk to their government. But beyond that, I think we're just trying to get all the pieces together in order for Jake to have counsel, get the testing done, and get some answers.
So Allison says another question. She said, the podcast raised two possible alternative scenarios. Is there one that you're leaning towards?
So I wouldn't say it was two alternative scenarios. There's definitely two alternative people of interest we've talked a lot about. But I think what the podcast showed is that, like what our investigation showed, is that we don't actually know what Renee's final days looked like. We know we have a good idea where she was now. She was probably with her friend, Tim Fisher, at a house, at least part of the time, at a house not too far from Home Depot, actually. We don't know an exact date. There's possible reason to think it was very close in time to when she died, but that doesn't mean that was her last stop. I mean, it kind of opens up all sorts of potential options here, because let's say she was with Tim and decided like she had enough of that and went home, and something happened on the way home. And we just don't know until Tim Fisher wants to talk to us again and give us some more answers about when he last saw her, where she last was. We've got a lot of options on the table. I don't think at this point we can say definitively or even have a solid answer. We can have ideas and guesses and look into them all, but there's room for so much to have happened that that's all we can say at this point. Other than that, we know certain people are not being forthcoming about what they know.
Right. Now, I thought that was really interesting, and that was well handled as well, because I think when you're in a smaller community and you start to find out that there are people who have a lot of connections to each other, and you're sort of having these moments of like, oh, wait, you do know these people? And like, oh, you guys did connect. Oh, you would have run into each other. Yeah. Then the temptation would be to go, I think we found everyone who would have possibly been, you know what I mean? Which maybe is less tempting if you're in Chicago or Los Angeles. So you're like, okay, well, there's infinite possibilities. But when you're in a smaller community, it probably is easy, not for you guys, because you obviously didn't do this, but to kind of go down the road of like, gosh, I think we must kind of have talked to everybody. And so it was such an important point to say, wow, this is a black hole. Like, we have a bit of a black hole here, and we have to leave open room for what we don't know, what we don't know.
Yeah. And we learned pretty quickly on, actually, you hear in the podcast before we realized this, our discussions, but like, you can't assume anyone doesn't know anyone in that town. At least back then. It's a bigger town now. It's much different now. But back then, like, you could not safely assume anyone didn't know anyone. And we had set up a couple of times where we had people from two different, not worlds, but two different sides of that community, very distant in age, location, like groups. And you would think it'd be safe to assume they weren't hanging out together, and find out like, no, they hung out all the time. They just casually knew someone somehow. And it can also have the opposite effect where it seems oversignificant. You're like, what are the odds they know each other? Well, pretty good, actually. So, But it does mean that like the range of possibilities is wider than you would initially imagine. Like, again, for Chicago, you wouldn't expect those kind of random cross world colliding kind of things. Here, you have to assume it happened to some degree.
So I want to get into now, this is the big spoiler stuff. So tune out now if you don't want to know what happens at the end of season two. Proof.
No one's calling my dog out. Sorry. I laugh.
Amy Asshole. Feels much better about her 80-pound boxer because of your dog barking. So at the end of your final episode, you guys are going through files, and you guys talk about what you found in the files that seems like everybody's been looking for years.
The thing is, did anyone even look for them? We know there was one request made by the defense back in 2016 when Jake did have an attorney, and Manteca police said, oh, we can't find the evidence in this case, and that was it. It turns out that the victim's clothing and her necklaces and some of the hairs, not all of them, some of the hairs from the crime scene were trial exhibits. And although records suggested they would have gone back to the Manteca Police Department, we think they just never did. Like, the clerk just had them and no one picked them up. So even the paperwork said they were, like, you know, processed back that they should have been, they just weren't. They're just there. It wasn't a big deal. They'll sit there forever till the end of time. And they were still there, and they were still in good condition, and they were still just waiting to be tested.
Yeah, the potential murder weapon is sitting in an envelope in a file somewhere.
No, an actual Ziploc bag, like a literal, like, says Ziploc. Like,
or you said sandwich bag. Yeah,
it's an actual Ziploc bag.
Like could have had a sandwich in it.
They could have had his head cut off.
Right. So
the killer was a piece of ham. I guess,
God. Right. It's a pig. I don't know. And along those lines, Tool Girl says, if they agree to test the hemp necklace for DNA, does the defendant have the right to request MVAC extraction, or is it up to the county to decide what collection method they use?
Good well, that's why I really, really want to get an attorney for Jake, because that way he can advocate how the testing is done.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Do you know, has there been any communication with the prosecutor's office in regards to what you found in testing, anything like that?
Nope. Not, I assume they know, but I have no knowledge of that. So.
So when you guys were done, it just got tucked right back in that file and stuck.
Oh yeah. We just, you know, back on the little cart and wheeled away again. So it's still there.
You guys were pretty chill about that. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
You know, when we were actually like, it was even chiller than like you're thinking. So like, you know, we're in a room, we're going fast. We had so much to do that day. You literally heard every bit of audio. It wasn't like we had to cut stuff out. That was literally right. The only audio with any emotion whatsoever. Oh my
God, you were in such a rush. That's so crazy. So like,
you and Jacinda are very different than me and Janet. Janet, could you imagine if it was me and you in there and we found that? Hey, Tuckers, get back here. Like,
we had only found all the audio. It was all like, get a picture. Like trying to boost it to make it usable for the show.
Crazy. Well, all the listeners did the excitement for
the shouting for us.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, I had to go back and listen to it again. I was like, I need to hear this again. I just need to hear them find this again. It's amazing.
Like, oh, of course it was here. I mean, in hindsight, it made sense. We're like, oh, I guess that's like the last place it would have. Like, if it's not anywhere else, they probably didn't throw it out. So like, kind of. Thinking backwards, like we probably could have guessed that's where it'd be, but we just hadn't put that together at the time. So like we go in to get the, you know, copy over VHS tapes and like, oh, here's the victim's pants. Here's her shirt. There you go. Like, oh, okay.
That's crazy.
Now, we are still missing some of the two of the hairs were there in the file. There are a bunch of other hairs that were found that could be interesting. We don't know. We still don't know where those are. Apparently, Manteca Police doesn't have those. The courts didn't have them. So those may be actually legit missing, including one hair that like Jacinda and Catherine are like, Susan, stop talking about this hair. It's the dumbest thing they've ever said in their life. Stop talking about it. But I want to know, because there was a dog hair found in her underwear, like poking out of her underwear, on her torso. And it was a long curly dog hair. And, you know, like it could be a lot of kind of dogs have that kind of hair. But we do know Jared Conway, the serial sex offender's mom, had a little Yorkie. Hmm. And like, that's, you know, definitely a kind of dog that would leave like a slightly wavy, long brown hair.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Yorkies are the one type of dog that have a very unique hair structure. So if it is a Yorkie hair, like you could basically, you don't even need DNA. You could eyeball that and be like, that's a Yorkie hair. Because it lacks the structure that all other dog hairs have. So that wouldn't prove anything, but if it was a Yorkie hair, I would definitely be side-eyeing Jared Conway even more.
Right.
They can't give you shit for that. The fact that there happens to be one type of dog that is so unique that its hair is like, of course you want to take a look. Of course you want more information.
Yeah. But it is a long shot and the hair is gone now anyway, but yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you want as much information as you can to help it. And there's always that, especially for me being non-lawyer, like, I'm like, I want to understand what's happening. You guys figure out how to make it a legal case, but like, that's part of understanding what might have happened there. And again, I was so encouraged, like when you guys found that stuff in that file, because that's like, again, in the case I'm working right now, they're telling me they don't know where the trial exhibits are. So like, I'm reading trial transcripts and they say, exhibit this is this transcript. Where is it?
They're not at the court.
Good question. That's what this is what I told the DA. I was like, listen, with what I've already found in my investigation, I'm fairly confident this conviction is going to be overturned. At which point, you're going to need to retry it one way or another. How are you going to do that with no evidence? Because you're telling me all the evidence.
Have you asked the court?
Yeah. So I started on, because generally in most systems I've worked in, the exhibits and transcripts and stuff are housed by the district clerk's office. And then, so usually I'll file a FOIA there for that stuff. And then I'll file a FOIA with the prosecutor's office for the DA's file. So I went to the district clerk's office and requested all the trial exhibits. And they said, oh, you got to go to the prosecutor. We don't carry that.
They said, we don't have it, or you got to go to the prosecutor first?
Essentially, she said you have to file your FOIA for that through the prosecutor. She didn't really say if they had it.
But she didn't say they didn't have it. So they probably have it and they're deflecting. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I file it with the prosecutor and they're like, and the lady calls. She's like, I'm looking through the file. There's no exhibits in here. I'm like, well, they're somewhere.
Yeah.
Where are they?
My guess is they're in the court. The court didn't want to be the one to hand it over. So they're telling you, you have to get the court's, the DA's permission, which may or may not be true. I don't know what I don't remember Michigan's laws there. So the Michigan, the DA is saying, truthfully, we don't have it. But what could be going on is a clerk isn't saying they don't have it at all. They're just saying they need the DA to get permission for the clerk to hand it over.
And they're definitely not, because I keep, like, in my email exchanges, in my FOIA, I to the DA, I'm saying, I want to know where they are. Like, you don't have to
tell
you.
They don't have to tell you where. Yeah, they just have to tell you that, like, if they don't know where it is, they don't have to, like, it depends on a lot on the context here, but yeah, it's theoretically possible your requests at the DA's office are only about stuff they have in their possession. So it's really the clerk you got to go back to and say, show me the law that says the DA's got to sign off on this. Like, if you have them, my request is to you. You have to hand them over, unless there's another law here, in which case the DA can be brought in. But the FOIA to the DA probably won't work if they don't actually have custody over those materials.
No. And that's so, and that was, it was like through email with the head DA I was talking to. I was like, procedurally, forget this case. When a trial's over, who then takes possession of the trial exhibit?
It depends.
Just refuses to answer the question.
Okay, so then they brought him.
Yeah, I'll ask five questions and I'll get a response back to four of them. And that one, nothing. They won't tell me anything.
So I'm gonna guess that's where it is. It sounds like they're not lost. They're just trying to COA producing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to take your advice. Now they have now officially finally told me that they are that they're producing my request. They won't tell me what's in it. They just want $1,000 for redacting that I sent them. And then I'm going to see what I get from them to see if I get the file. Cause I also asked for a chain of custody for the trial exhibits. I don't know if they will even have one.
They should. Oh, you know, that can, you know, as you can see from our case, I can get screwed up too. But yeah.
Yeah. But there should be something in there that says where they went next.
There should be.
Yeah.
Like,
when you really like break down the sleight of hands and stuff that happen in the legal system, it's if it weren't so sad, it would be funny in the sense that it's like, this is what children do. This is like what a child does. A child is like, wait a minute. What if I say I don't know where it is? Like this sort of, you know, giving people the runaround is just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is where we are. Where we are is you hide one sheet of paper in 2,000 sheets of paper that aren't related. And that's your approach? Like, that's where we are?
Like, sometimes it's calculated, but, like, at least as often, a little more often probably, it's just people trying to avoid doing anything.
Like, yeah, I appreciate
that. If they can check off a sheet and say, well, it's not, well, I personally don't have it, so I guess I'm not doing this. Yeah. Cool. Done.
It's not my problem.
Like, there's a bigger problem. Yeah, it's a not my problem kind of thing more often than it is like a, oh, shit, let's make sure it doesn't get out.
Well, and I know you were careful to say, I was just going to say you were careful to say that in this last season too, where, you know, you start to be able to go down the road of like, wait a minute, there's a reason that this doesn't exist, or there's a reason that this hasn't happened. And you're always very pragmatic and are like, just to be clear, we're also not saying that this is a huge conspiracy. Like, there's other very like plain other reasons, bureaucratic reasons that stuff like this can happen too, or just laziness.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my case, it's a new DA. This DA has only been in office for a couple of years. This case happened in 2001. Like, there's no reason for anything. And even through like the trial transcripts, it doesn't really look like anything nefarious that happened didn't happen at the DA's office. The only hiccup in the whole thing is the lead detective on the case, who may be responsible for this potential wrongful conviction, is now the police chief and is the one that is dealing with the DA and all of this.
Wait, so
that
the DA is the.
No. The detective responsible for this is now the chief of police.
I got it. Yeah, that's
and is the one that is now the one that they're because it's small town, you know, it's smaller city, so the one they're communicating with about this file. So it's hard for me not to be after 10 years of doing this a little jaded. Like, what are you guys up to? come on, let's go.
Yeah.
Let me buzz through here and see if they have anything else and we'll let you go. I know one big one that we had from Grayson. He wants to know, do you know what your next season of Proof will be and when can we expect it?
Get back to work.
Take Mr. no
Grayson,
vacation.
Give me a moment here. But no, we do not.
Now, is there going to be a season 3 of Proof?
I hope so, and we'll be working on it, not today.
Right. Girl, I understand. Take a fucking break. Take a breath. And the last question I have for you, and I'll see if Jana has anything else to ask, is I'm realizing now how long it's been since you and I have talked. How's being a mom?
Busy.
Right. How old's your son now?
His daughter. She's 2.
Oh, daughter's 2 years old.
Yeah, she's 2. And I have learned that trying to do witness interviews with a 2-year-old
is
more problematic than I even imagined. And I knew it would be problematic. But she definitely, if you ever hear like really weird audio in the season, there's a few points you do, like where you hear like a janky, like meh, and it cuts off and suddenly goes to the next word. That's a 2-year-old screaming. I got edited out. Right. Like, meh. Okay. Cut the word out. Let's try and pat it together.
Do you foresee any future siblings in her future?
Not there's a season 3 of Proof.
that's the sibling. The sibling is season 3 of Proof. This is my other child.
All right. Well, Janet,
kids are
you have
easier. Kids
else?
Take 9 months to make. The season of the podcast takes way longer.
Yeah,
right, but then
exactly.
The little fuckers stick around for like 20 years after that.
So do my podcast seasons.
Right.
They're just accumulating. Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. No, yeah, I'm good. That was my question was definitely the same as Grayson's, but Grayson, I wasn't brave enough to ask it because I knew that Susan had just finished.
All right. Well, with that being said, Susan, we will let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thanks for having me. Good to
talk again. Yeah,
you too. And see ya. Great work.
Both seasons of Proof.
If you see, definitely let me know. If I'm ever out your way, which I might be, I got some cases kind of that way. I'll hit you up, Bob.
Yeah, for sure. Let's catch up soon. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, everybody, in the live chat. And we'll talk to you guys on Friday.
Yes.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at putthemina.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of createdintandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.